Hey, Steele, how you doing?
Doing awesome, Dave. How are you?
I'm awesome. I got Ryan here with me today.
Hey, Ryan, welcome back, man.
Hey, I'm glad to be here, really.
We got a few interesting things for you today. We've got some talk about time travel. We're actually gonna introduce our first class to the Off the Chain Hall of Fame. It's a big thing. It's something that me and Steele have been really pondering over, and we've got a couple of people we're nominating that we're gonna put in the hall, and I feel really good about. We got some songs for you, and I'm just really excited. You ready,
Yeah.
Steele?
Yeah, man. First ballot Hall of Famers, you know they're going to be great. I mean, we're excited to welcome our initial class to the Off the Chain Hall of Fame. That's what I'm most geeked for.
Yeah, I think that everyone's excited about it, but we're going to make you anticipate it a little bit because we're going to start by talking a little bit about time travel. So, Steele, when you think time travel, what two movie franchises immediately come to mind?
Well, clearly the first one is the documentary series Bill and Ted's. They had an excellent adventure and they had a bogus journey, and both of those were outstanding. I mean, that was really when I was introduced to the science of time travel. And then, if you want to go more fanciful and more theoretical, this is a fiction film series, but Back to the Future was also really good.
Yes, those two series pretty much define what we now know as time travel. It's from those that our understanding of time travel really was born. Really, each film kind of introduces a different theory related to time travel, a slightly different perspective on it. What do you think might be the differences between the films, Ryan?
Right, so besides one being a documentary and one being a really good guess, yeah, I gotta think about that one. So in Back to the Future, we've got
I mean, it was based on a true story, at least. So it just wasn't the act, they didn't have the cameras there at the time.
No, it's a reenactment, but
Yeah,
a
thanks.
faithful one, we understand. Now, if I had to guess at like what the difference between the core underlying difference between the two films, I mean, rock and roll. Wait, no, they both have that. I don't know, I'm stumped.
Okay. Do you know the core difference still? Because I know it. So I'm kind of quizzing you guys. This is your test.
Yes. For
Let's hear
me, the core difference is the role of expertise and authority.
it.
In Back to the Future, Doc has to be present, and the machine has to reach certain conditions. It requires this kind of scientific necessity in order for Marty to move forward or back through time. Well, in the documentary, there is a guy who comes from the future with a machine that's just a phone booth. And the reason he's able to do it is because the characters in that film have changed the world in a way that time travel became possible in the future. They were the authority. They didn't need some doc, some scientist to help them travel through time. They themselves made the conditions of time travel possible through their choices, their excellent choices in the present.
So, yeah, Bill and Ted do have a power to them that Marty will never have. We can agree to that. But in the initial films, Marty can shred on the guitar while Bill and Ted do have to go to guitar camp. So Marty actually has them there.
Another crucial difference is Bill and Ted are capable of encountering themselves. Like when they're
Right.
traveling through time, they land in that 7-Eleven parking lot, they meet themselves twice. They meet themselves before they've met themselves, right? And then they return and meet themselves after they've met themselves. And in Back to the Future, Marty's existence is imperiled by his past or his future traveling. Like there's that moment when he goes in the past and he begins to start disappearing from that Polaroid. His existence is threatened because Biff's about to beat up his dad and make it with his mom, so he might not exist. And he can't encounter himself in his travels in the way that Bill and Ted can.
that's the underlying difference in actually the time travel theory presented by both films. In Bill and Ted's, the past and the future, the past can't be affected by, if you travel to the past and do something, just say Napoleon, like you take him to a water park, that's not going to change his, what he can do in the past in France, because that's something he's already experienced. The timeline is already taken into account, the fact that Napoleon has been to a water park. It's not going to change Napoleon's life because this has already occurred. While Back to the Future, Marty could screw anything up. Like he runs a car into the wrong person. All of a sudden, Bill Clinton's never president.
Yeah, and like the mall, the name of the mall changes, right? That was my favorite detail that I noticed as a kid. It's like Twin Pines versus like Lone Pine because of the car crashes into the tree. It's a small detail, but I think it's when the Libyans are coming with their rocket launcher that happens.
So I like the discussion. I like what's going, but Rufus, in the beginning of, he says that things are very excellent. In fact, they have the most water parks of any planets that they've contacted, and there's really great things happening, but it almost isn't that way. So he has to go back in time to make sure that the excellent ones, Bill and Ted, have the right conditions and basically pass their exam so that he doesn't have to go on to military boot camp and then they can form their band and create most excellent.
Right, I agree. So Dave, like, how do you deal with this fact? Like, the present is able to come back and the future is able to come back and affect the present, so the future turns out a certain way. So only a certain range of historical time is malleable in Bill and Ted's universe?
No, nothing is actually malleable. Well, I mean, you still have
it could not be otherwise.
But it's just how our perspective on time. Like, Rufus has come back and done that. That's something that's happened. So the future is set. That future is going to happen. It's perhaps Bill and Ted themselves sent Rufus back. I would assume that they did. They talked to Rufus and said, "You're going to go have. We've met you before. You're going to take care of this issue. Like, go for it."
So they couldn't screw it up. There's no possibility of failure in Bill and Ted's, is what you're saying.
That's rough. Yeah. Because the thing is, no, there's not. Because you have Keanu Reeves in the lead role. He is
and
never
Alex
screwed
Winter.
Up.
Don't sleep on Alex Winter, Dave.
Yes. Yeah. I would posit one other possibility. I'm just throwing this out there, and I'm at a bit of a disadvantage because, and I know this is rough, but I haven't actually seen the second Bill and Ted's movie entirety.
Whoa.
I know.
Dave,
you
invited the wrong guest on this week.
I'm so sorry.
Friggin'.
Here's the deal. I was a child of the 90s, and my older siblings dictated what was cool and what wasn't, and they said, "Oh, it's a sequel. It probably won't be cool." They were wrong. I know.
Yeah.
But
they meet death.
That's what happened to me as a child. That's my pain.
Well, okay, anyway, so you haven't seen the second one, so you don't really know anything. But go ahead, proceed.
I know. Like, all I can do is go based off of the First Testament. what if them going back in time and, you know, kidnapping Socrates and Napoleon and Joan of Arc and all that is what creates the conditions for us to learn an alternate history about these historical characters? And really, that's what had to happen all along. So it's not even that that what we know as history is necessarily correct, but by their being kidnapped out of time, we get this alternative history that's passed on down to us. And then I think that's one way of closing the loop.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, like, so the reason why one third of the planet is descended from Bob Genghis Khan was because he encountered mall security and he found the Twinkies and he realized the power of aluminum baseball bats. Therefore, he was able to spread his seed widely.
Precisely.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me. Dave, you got a counterargument to that?
Well, I'm just trying to think, are we talking about predestination versus the right of choice? Is that actually what's happening? Is Bill and Ted, were they predestined to be wild stallions?
I think so.
Yes?
I think that's the argument you're making, and I think that's kind of convincing in a way. And
yes.
And there's much more power of choice in Back to the Future.
And it's just not as funny. Back to the Future is not as comical. So predestination then would seem to be the more humorous form of time travel theory.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, on the continuum of humorous forms of time travel theory, Predestination is good. I mean, there is also, there's no character in Back to the Future who can compare with Missy. Mom? I mean, that's, she's just off the chain.
She is super cool. And the other thing about Back to the Future is in the second film, Michael J. Fox goes to the future and sees his future self, and he's just like a turd. He's not cool at all. And you know the future of Bill and Ted.
Yeah.
They're going to be wild stallions. Like, who are you more interested in? Michael J. Fox, future turd, or the rock band that brings peace to the world?
Right, and in that case, it's really kind of egocentric. It's just like, it's all about Marty McFly, and it's not that great, but they changed society, Bill and Ted did.
They totally did. And the other interesting thing is, the women who changed society with them were actually born like 500 or 600 years before them. They came from the past, but stayed in the present. And that's a cool move. That doesn't happen Back to the Future.
No. Oh my gosh. No, Marty's girlfriend, the actress, changed from film to film. They didn't even stick with the same actors in Back to the Future.
Is it maybe that he tampered with time, and every time he came back, he just saw a different girl and thought, this has always been my girlfriend. I mean, who knows? I can't go down that wormhole.
It's possible. Lone Pine, Twin Pines, that's the girlfriend theorem. So the other thought that I have that I think is really important about Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure is, for me at least, it provided so much more historical richness. Like, for example, in the history books, you never learn Socrates' last name. You only get it from the film. You only learn that it's Socrates Johnson if you pay close attention. And the other thing that's really important is Napoleon's love of ice cream.
Yes.
Like, that's the moment, that's the kind of turning point in that film where Deacon loses him and he does the Piggy Wiggy challenge or whatever, but Deacon has a kind of crucial plot role in that film, and none of Marty McFly's siblings seem like, does he even have siblings? Like his sister or something, right? They're just not memorable.
No, they're pretty lame. But I do want to point one thing out, though. Napoleon was actually 5'6" still. He's not that short. He's about my height.
Not that short.
In context, but
he's been slandered. He has been slandered.
But what are your thoughts concerning, should Napoleon have known that Waterloo was going to be a bad idea for him? Or did he, because the water park was named Waterloo, he was like, things are going to work out.
Exactly. He was lulled into a false sense of security. He wanted to go complete the thing he had failed. Like, he wanted to do more rides, if you remember. He didn't want to stop. They had to pull him from that place kicking and screaming. So any chance he has to go back to Waterloo, no matter how bad the odds are stacked against him, he's going back. Thanks a lot, Deacon.
Chase the Waterloo Dragon.
Chase the Waterloo. Yeah, that should have been the tagline of the Napoleon historical film that came out after it. Chase the Waterloo Dragon. That'd be awesome movie poster.
So I guess what we've learned from this conversation is, one, Ryan needs to watch Bogus Journey. And two, if you're going to look into time travel theory, I'd recommend watching both franchises, but invest in Bill and Ted's. That's going to be where you want to head. I mean, if you're going to time travel, what would you rather go on? A phone booth that's easily set, no issues, or a friggin' car that you have to steal plutonium from terrorists to use?
I mean,
when the phone booth breaks, all you need is some bubble gum.
Yep.
When the DeLorean breaks, you need to know exactly when lightning's going to strike. You're kind of hosed.
And more than that, you have to know how to even build this time machine and repair it and whatnot. And you have to have advanced quantum physics and engineering degrees. I mean, no, thank you.
All you need to do is dial a number and you're set if you have a phone booth. The user interface is vastly superior in Bill and Ted's.
Yeah, because it was, I think it was engineered through rock and roll. So,
yeah, those wormholes.
But I think, you know, we can come back to this conversation another time, but this is bringing us in a direction that Ryan actually has some expertise in. When we're talking time, what does that immediately bring you to, Ryan?
For me, time capsules.
Time capsules?
Time capsules. And treasure chests, things of that sort. let me explain. I really like time capsules. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not really into time capsules buried in, like, you know, the courthouse cornerstone by the class of, you know, 65 or something like that. That's all well and good.
Class of 65
sucked. What I really
sucked.
Like is, like, well, yeah, I pick a year. But what I really like is, like, personal time capsules. Here's why. And every society wants to build itself such that it continues into the future. And everyone's trying to erect monuments to, you know, all their accomplishments and whatnot. Societies want to inherently preserve themselves and pass on to a next generation who they are. But the lone individual who makes a time capsule is awesome because they're not so, you know, grandiose as to think that I'm going to be remembered in the future. I think we all live great lives that ultimately get forgotten. But the time capsuler knows this is my shot. If I make a time capsule, and if I set it up in the right way, in the future, someone is going to be really stoked that I was alive and that I decided to pass on this message. I'm a property manager, or I was, and so anytime I opened up a wall when there was, like, flood damage or something like that, I decided I'm going to write a message. Future's going to know. So whether it's just marker on some sheetrock, or my favorite way is to get a mason jar, write out a note on some archival paper and ink, and heat the thing up, and then put it, you know, put your note in there, seal it up, and then when it cools, it forms a little bit of a seal, put them in a wall, put it in an attic.
That's amazing. I thought you were going to say mason jar filled with urine or something disgusting. Come on, man. You know, Dave, I'm going to ask, does this qualify as a time capsule? So I used to live in an apartment with two other guys. We all shared a bedroom, and Dave lived next door. And one day he decided to prove the point that no one in our apartment washed their laundry very often. He took like a mostly empty carton of milk with like a half inch of milk left in and buried it under somebody's laundry. And it was like a month later before we found his time capsule. And we're like, this laundry smells disgusting. And then it was curdled milk. Is that a time capsule? Would that qualify, Ryan?
You know what? Yes. Yes, it does. In fact, it's one of the best kinds. It has a really kind of like an every man's King Tut's curse sense to it. Like, when you find this, it's not going to be okay for whoever finds it.
Dave was hoping we'd go a decade or two and really stand the test of time, but we didn't make it.
My favorite time capsule I've ever accidentally hidden is, still, you may remember, I attended law school for a short time. I dropped out. It didn't go well for me. I moved across the country. I emptied out my bank account in cash, and I put this cash in my suitcase. You know, suitcase cash makes sense, right? I found $1,000 cash 2 years later. I was like, whoa, jackpot! Like, why do I have $1,000 cash in my suitcase?
Wow.
It's because I'm an idiot. It's my time capsule from 2 years ago.
Can I just say that? I want to make the kind of money where I can miss $1,000, or I can lose $1,000 and not miss it. Be like, oh, there's that $1,000.
See, my perspective, I was thinking Dave emptied his whole bank account, and it was just $1,000. Sad. He had more going on than just dropping out of law school.
The best part of it, yeah, the story. I moved. Everything that I owned fit in the trunk of my Honda Civic. I had probably about $1,500 cash to my name, $1,000 of which I never found.
Wow. Well, Dave, I'm glad you made it through that dark patch.
So do you have any suggestions or anything you want to throw out there to the listeners, what they can do to try time capsules, ideas you have?
You can start small. There was my wife did a series, did a play called The Mother Stories, and it was an examination of like multiple generations of women. And anyway, what came up in it was this tradition of writing stocking notes. So you write a note to yourself and you put it in your stocking when you put it away for Christmas. And then the next year when you go to pull your stocking out, you know, you got your note and it's only a year old. That's one easy form of kind of like writing to the future.
So the idea is that you have something that's like seasonal or that's only used annually and you play kind of message.
So
that's cool. I like that.
To check back in with yourself. Some of my favorite things to put in a time capsule are predictions. If you've ever looked back at like a popular science magazine from the 40s or 50s, they've got these really great ideas about what the future is going to look like,
uh-huh.
And they're so wrong all the time. it's always fun to see what the past thought the future would look like. So I love predictions. I like describing just like everyday life, the cost of things, some things that are going on in my life, some of my political views or, you know, ideas on life, whatever it might be. Just kind of a personal thing. Just kind of like a little personal conversation to whoever's there. Oh, and I always include a couple lines about how this time's capsule is meant for the finder. I meant to talk to you. You, the finder, this is for you.
So one of the things that's striking to me, Ryan, about what you're saying there is you're not talking about putting objects, really, but you're talking almost purely communication, like some kind of message or some kind of text. It seems more like a message in a bottle, even,
yeah,
than like a time capsule full of objects.
I'd agree, and invariably I'll put like some coins in there, either from the year that I'm putting it, or in one I did a series of pennies every year from now, I think it was a couple years ago, to like 75 or something like that.
Oh, that's cool.
Because I think one of the cool things about time capsules is you have the opportunity to almost age an object untouched, kind of like wine in a cask, and if you put coins from this day in 50 years, maybe they'll be worth something to them. Who knows?
When you're thinking about doing this and planning this out, are you putting some way for the person who finds it to contact you? Are you putting identifying information, or are you remaining anonymous? What's your philosophy on this?
I'm not scared, and I've thought about that at length, and I'm not afraid. I put my information, I put my parents' names, and I put any of my former addresses, just so that I have a way, if they're searching public records, to find me. I would love to connect with someone in 25 years.
I love it, instead of like, I'm putting all the information they would need to search public records. Like, I imagine finding a thin name in the bottle. Like, I'm like, oh, I'm going to do a public record search. I mean, that would be really effective, but it's not the first immediate way I'd think to find someone.
I think you need to throw your social security number in there,
yeah,
too. Credit card numbers. You need to really get down to the nitty-gritty.
What you really ought to do is, this would be kind of terrible, but you're like, you know how you get those terrible email spam messages about someone who has a bank account in Switzerland and their relative died and they need you to help claim it? Instead of doing that scam message, just describe how you have a locked, like a loft safe box in a Swiss bank in Zurich, and give them the key and be like, if you travel there and give them this information, you can unlock it. So it's like a fake key and they travel to Switzerland, unlock the lockbox, but it's not really there. Or it is there and there's a note inside that just says, thanks for finding me, and that's it. I don't know.
Yes, exactly.
Do you have a favorite time capsule you've ever done?
Yeah, well, one of them was, I call it the ice capsule. My wife's grandparents live up in Utah, and they have to run their water in the winter constantly, or else, you know, pipes will freeze. So rather than be boring about it, they set up like wood, you know, structures and sticks and stuff in a really geometric way, and then they run a sprinkler over it. And what ends up happening is it builds this huge ice structure, this castle, and it looks amazing. And one year we visited, and it was near Thanksgiving, and it had just started to form ice. And so I got the kids together, their grandkids and stuff, and we all wrote messages to them talking about memories of them and of the house. And we hid it in a mason jar inside the ice capsule. And then, of course, the structure continued to grow, and then, you know, it got warm enough to where they didn't really run it, and it started to thaw. So like 5 or 6 months later, when Grandpa was out kind of cleaning up the ice structure, he found this bottle. And it's one of his most prized possessions. So that was one of my favorites. One other one that really kind of got me started in this whole thing, it's not a time capsule I did, but that one that I found. My aunt used to do estate sales. She would clear them out for people. And then when she was down to like heavier stuff, she'd call in my dad and we would come help like move things. We would always look for money in books and pockets and stuff, because sometimes people just hide money in these things. In
their suitcases.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like Dave. And anyway, so we were striking out. We couldn't find anything. And then it was just my dad and I in a trailer. We were moving some of the last pieces of furniture. There was a desk in an old office. My dad said, there's got to be something in this desk, because there's often false drawers in desks. And so we looked and looked and didn't find anything. We went to lift it, and we noticed that the front paneling was kind of decorative in such a way that maybe it could open up, which is a really weird thing to think. But sure enough, we pulled on the side of it, and the front panel of this desk opened right up, and there was a small 6-inch hollow-out cavity, and we saw just an old Kodak picture or a camera box in there. I said, oh, well, it's just a camera, and my dad said, I doubt it, and he grabbed that. We opened it up, and there was a little wooden box inside, plus a velvet purse, and it was full of silver coins and a couple of gold ones. And it came to be probably around $150 worth of old coins. Wow. And my dad gave me everything that was in the box, and that's one of my most prized possessions. And from that point forward, I knew that the world had mysteries. I knew there were things that people could stumble upon and find, and that it could be magical.
That's awesome.
That is awesome. I imagine if I had a time travel movie, how much it would have ruined your life if someone had gone back and just put like a dead mouse in there instead. I know that the world has mysteries, and they're all terrible.
Things you don't want to find, yeah.
Speaking of time capsules, we have a little wooden box lined in velvet that we're looking to fill up right now called Off the Chain Hall of Fame.
We need some kind of theme song for that.
The theme song is just, you can feel it in your head. The music's going right now. So we got two nominations. I guess not nominations. What would they be called, Steele?
Successful nominations, elected things, two inductions. That's it.
All right. Inducted into the Hall of Fame today. What do we got from
Well,
you,
Dave,
Steele?
The thing that I'm inducting into Off the Chain Hall of Fame is the humble rec specs, or just athletic eyewear generally. In my opinion, so as I was mentioning, I play pickup soccer, and a little while ago I was out playing pickup soccer, and a guy showed up wearing rec specs, just played the whole game with rec specs. And it had been a while since I'd seen them, but I was humbled anew and just amazed with how awesome rec specs are. They're like full-on goggles that help you see better, but also keep moisture. I don't know what I don't know all of their properties because I haven't worn them, but just seeing them, like as a third person observing them, I'm blown away. And so I went ahead and I made a little compilation of all of the famous professional athletes that I could think of, famous and unfamous alike, that wore some kind of eyewear while fulfilling their athletic responsibilities, wearing rec specs. And the list was just extraordinary and really amazing. If you were to think first athletes that you guys think of that you associate with eyewear or rec specs, anybody come to mind?
I got two. Of course, there's Kurt Rambis,
yes,
which would probably be first for anyone. And then I lived in Houston growing up for a little while, at least. So Akeem.
And both of those guys were more like, Akeem used to have the circle goggles, and then Kurt Rambis was amazing because they just looked like black frame glasses. And I don't know if they were taped on or if he had like Croakleys in the back or how he kept them on, but they weren't even rec specs. They were like the step below rec specs.
No, it felt like he Harry Potter got his glasses from Kurt Rambis.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much. Now, I think in the world of football, they're kind of extraordinary because they're so rare. I think Eric Dickerson's probably the most famous guy, and there's a couple of great photos of him with like rec specs and turtleneck. That's a double Hall of Fame look right there.
Ooh. That's a hit song, Red Specs and Turtlenecks.
Yeah, isn't that? Thank you. I need a musical ear. There's lots and lots and lots of great Rec Specs throughout history. But my favorite Rec Specs story actually comes from the realm of soccer, since I'm going to tie it all together here. There was a Dutch defender named Joop van Dele. He played for Feyenoord. And during the 1970 Intercontinental Cup, and an opposing player took his glasses off, threw them on the ground, and stomped on them. So broke his glasses, took away his competitive advantage. And the glasses, the broken glasses, they are now exhibited in the club museum as this relic of unsportsmanlike conduct, I suppose. So anyway, rec specs. Nominate them.
I think Dickerson's specs are the handsomest ones that I see. Just from style alone. Like, if I were going to play a professional sport and wear specs, I'd go with what Dickerson's doing, because it's fantastic.
Dave, you Absolutely. Might think that now, and you need to do yourself a favor. I want you to Google Ato Boldon, A-T-O space B-O-L-D-O-N. But this guy's a Trinidadian sprinter.
Oh, yeah.
Do you see those? Now that.
Yes.
The amazing thing about these is they don't connect on the – they don't go over the ears. They go over the top of his head somehow. He looks like a futuristic Vin Diesel character. I don't know.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Like, he should be in a Riddick movie.
Yeah, he was in a Riddick. He's the inspiration for Riddick.
Yeah.
Hall of Fame. Well,
Riddick
instantly.
Does have to wear glasses like that in the sunshine because he sees in the dark. No, I'm still – no, Dickerson wins.
Okay.
Come on, Steel.
All right, Dave.
Got Dickerson.
You've got your opinion. You're welcome to it. So that's my Hall of Fame induction. Rex Becks, welcome to the Off the Chain Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I think that's a very honorable first inductee. But when compared to the second inductee, it's pretty much garbage. The second inductee is one of my favorite actors of all time. Steele, and we recently lost him. I remember exactly where I was when I received a text message saying that he passed, and I thought it was just a cruel, cruel joke. Like, I really thought, like, you don't joke about that. That's just not appropriate. Like, it got me angry. And so I immediately stopped the movie I was watching and I searched, and it was true. Paul Walker had died in an automobile accident. And the first thing I thought is that is impossible. Paul Walker could not die while driving a car. And while reading the article, I found that he was not the one driving. So that's the only way that Paul could have passed in that way.
I had that same thought. Like, there's no way this is a joke. You can't tell me that Paul Walker died in a race car. Like, I figured it had to have been, like, a description about the upcoming movie. But no, yeah, I couldn't believe it either.
You know, Dave, I do vaguely recall hearing it, and I thought, oh, I bet Dave's really crushed. And then I remember thinking, oh, this is really sad, and looking up Paul Walker's IMDb page. And you're going to hate me, realizing that I have never seen any of the films or TV shows in which he has appeared as an actor. So I am not his audience, but I feel sad for you, man.
Steele, I mean, I could walk you through every film on his IMDb page
I have never seen anything, but I did see Highway to Heaven. I just don't recall his appearance in that episode in the 80s. So I guess I saw his first credit.
But, I genuinely love Paul Walker. He was not a good actor. He wasn't talented in that department, but he did it. He kept showing up. He kept doing the films. His handsomeness is overpowering. I just want to talk about two of his films quickly, just to kind of talk about the kind of man he is. One is a film called 8 Below. Have either of you ever seen that film?
Can't say I've had that pleasure.
And still, I know you haven't. In this film, Paul Walker is living in Antarctica. He drives a dog sled, and they have to evacuate Antarctica very quickly, and his dogs get left behind. So the film is all about Paul Walker going to any length to get back to Antarctica to save his dogs. And he made me believe every moment of it. Just his relationship with the dogs is beautiful. He goes through and he names each one and he tells you the strengths and character of each dog. And by the end, like, you feel like you know the dogs too.
That's a special gift. If an actor can help you understand the innate character of each of the dogs, you've got to do a lot of interpreting because the dogs probably don't have a lot of dialogue.
No, but their personalities shine through once Paul Walker tells you. And in the scenes where it's just the dogs in the snow, you know, fighting polar bears, like, you're really pulling for old Jack. You want old Jack to make it.
And that's a tribute to Paul, really. I mean, that's a tribute to Paul. Paul Walker, dog interpreter.
And the second one that I just want to talk about briefly is the second movie in the Fast and Furious franchise. Vin Diesel decided not to do the sequel. I'm not sure why. So they looked to Paul and said, Paul, you have to carry this movie. And he said, not only will I carry this movie, but I will drive a car off a dock, launch it onto a moving boat to destroy the villain at the very end of the film. And he does that. And he takes this villain's money, he puts it down into his jeans so that he can use it for his own profit. And it's just amazing. The fact that Paul kept this franchise alive when Diesel said, I've had enough. And now the franchise is one of the most successful movie franchises in history. I look forward to seeing Furious 7 and Paul's last performance.
You know, actually, this is a tribute to kind of how great a reputation that Paul Walker has in my mind because of you, Dave, that when you mentioned that he put the villain's money down his pants, I thought that the next thing that you were going to say was that it burned up. I'd have been like, that's amazing.
But in real life, like, I only know Paul through movies, obviously, and I think most of them are pretty hilarious for reasons that Paul may not have intended, but I think he knew that they're a little bit silly, but like just in real life he was a nice guy. It's unfortunate he did some good things, and it just seemed like a kind man. And I'm genuinely sorry he's gone, because I love any movie Paul Walker's in. Like, I will see it. Like, you give me any Paul Walker movie, I'm sitting down, I'm watching it, and you know I'm laughing 8 to 10 times no matter what. I love it.
I get the sense from him when you're watching his movies. It's almost like watching video of someone on like a roller coaster. You're not there on the roller coaster, but you think to yourself, man, that looks fun. And he really sells that. So, yeah.
A certain joie de vivre. So, Dave, I'm sorry we've lost him, but I'm glad that we were able to induct him into the Off the Chain Hall of Fame. First ballot, surefire.
But that's our first Hall of Fame class. Off the Chain Hall of Fame, Rex Specs. And Paul Walker. They're fantastic.
Beautiful.
Couple of immortals.
So on to the next segment, guys. As you know, sometimes we take questions at Off the Chain. And this one is a question from Natasha. Usually still reads the question. So this is new for me. I'm going to see if I can read through an entire paragraph here. Natasha says, I'm in a local alternative rock band in Provo, Utah called Exit Athena. We are a pretty new band, and we would like to know if you have any advice on how to make our upcoming shows off the chain.
Wow, so that's for me?
We all might throw a little bit in there.
Yeah, absolutely. Alternative rock band in Provo, Utah. Already, you're pretty off the chain. That's fantastic. Provo's got a really great growing music scene, but you can take it to the next level. And here's how you do it. You have to diversify a little bit. You need to create the Venn diagram between the burgeoning electronic music industry that I kind of delve into as a DJ and that gritty alternative rock. So take a few notes. Fog machines, confetti cannons, air horns, all good things. Maybe dancers on stage, laser light effects. Anything you can do to give the people a visual show, go for it. Costumes worked for Kiss and later on Guar, though I don't really listen to their music.
But you know who they are.
I know who they are because of their costumes.
Along those lines, one of the most memorable concerts I've ever seen is I saw the Flaming Lips on New Year's Eve in Oklahoma City, their hometown. And of course, they brought out all the heavy hitters. They had people in bunny suits on stage dancing. Wayne got into a large ball and rolled around the crowd. Their confetti guns. They handed out laser pointers to everyone. And I know, Natasha, you might not have the budget for that, but you find one person in a bunny suit, you put them on stage, your crowd's going to go nuts. Any kind of animal suit, really. Gorilla, bunny, whatever, get them on stage with you. It's going to make a difference.
Absolutely. That's not so much a gimmick as a bookmark. People remember that.
And here's what I think. Yeah, it's true. What I think is a good strategy for what you're talking about, Dave, is instead of just bringing them out from backstage onto the stage, you have them come into the venue in the suit during the show. And then you make some kind of surprise comment. You're like, oh, man, our music must have brought the primates in. There's a primate in the audience. And then you bring the primate up on stage as if they're coming in from the audience and you do some kind of great thing. That's amazing. The only other thing that I would add is that this is a low cost, low budget idea, but it matters. It's that people are going to these concerts for an experience. And many of them are going to be spectators, but experiences often mean more when we participate in them. So if you think of a sincere, authentic way that matches your musical aesthetic to help the audience participate with you in making music, making a song happen, making that experience, that goes a long way. And it may be as simple and corny as like a sing-along in some way, or it may be some other way that the audience is involved in making this experience matter. But that's, I think, the core of what like makes a show off the chain for me.
It reminds me of a concert I went to about a year ago, a band called Lucius. two female lead singers that I love them. They're great, always harmonizing. But for their encore, they came out, and I don't think this would work in all settings or with all bands. It might be cheesy in some circumstances, but they came out into the crowd with acoustic instruments and played the final song just right out there in the middle of all of us. And it was, I really enjoyed it.
I was thinking about Chuck Berry's version of My Ding-a-ling, you know, when he gets everybody singing and what happened. And I mean, that's audience involvement. You don't have to cover that song necessarily, but that might be great for Provo.
Are you trying to tell us that you time traveled? Oh, wait, not your ding-a-ling, but the song My Ding-a-ling.
No, Chuck Berry had nothing to say about my personal ding-a-ling, but he had a song and that was titled My Ding-a-ling.
See, I thought you were trying to tell us that you Marty McFly'd him as an inspiration.
Yeah, you know, hey, Barry, this is your cousin. Or hey, Chuck, this is your cousin. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, Natasha, thanks for the question. I hope what we said helped. And, yeah, we look forward to hearing from you and hearing from Exit Athena. That's great.
Yeah,
I'm going to look them up. We love music at Off the Chain. So we're going into our next segment here, Unchained Melodies. We each have a song for you today. Steele, why don't you lead us off? What do you got?
This is a song. This one's for you, Dave. I was thinking about you. And I thought, Dave has triplets. And the music matters in his relationship with these three kids. And I thought, what could inspire Dave and his children to love music even more? So I found a band that's comprised of three siblings. They're not triplets, unfortunately, but they are three siblings. They're from England. And their names are Kitty, Daisy, and Lewis. This song is called Baby Bye Bye. And it's a sweet, old-timey kind of sounded song for you and your girls, Dave.
Does the brother always sing the lead, or do the girls get involved too? What do they do? Do you know?
You're asking the wrong guy. I just wanted to get a triplet song there. And no, I believe that they have different musical talents. I don't know who the lead vocalist is. So I don't know. I'm not even sure if Kitty and Daisy are women. I mean, they're English men, so they could be.
I just looked up their website. They seem like fairly attractive young women. So,
looks can be deceiving, Dave. You never know.
Well, beauty is only skin deep. It's about what's in your heart that matters. And Ryan has a good heart. He's got a song for us. What do you got for us today?
I wanted to share Scenic's Hours on End. Now, I guess part of the hazard of the profession of DJing is I'll pick up all sorts of like random little songs and I'll like the song, but I won't even necessarily know the group very well. So I can't say that I'm like an expert on Scenic. I don't know their albums or if they even put out more than this EP, but this song stuck with me for whatever reason. It's called Hours on End.
Yeah.
That's one of those songs that really, really builds. It's got that reverb-drenched kind of neo-80s revival in a way. That's really...
Yeah, they make good use of echo effect, I'm sure. But the lyrics are a little bit hard to discern, but they've got some pretty cool lyrics. And it's just kind of like a dreamy... I don't know, it reminds me of water, just kind of like flowing. Mm. But yeah, I just like it. It just kind of sticks with me. It puts me in a mood, like a good mood. I can't even describe necessarily, but I feel more love towards humanity.
That's good to have. That's like a positive chill-out song then, for sure.
Yes, exactly.
Well, speaking of love towards humanity and my triplets, this may not shock you or Ryan to hear that when we put the girls to bed, we sing to them. There's usually three songs, different songs that I'll sing, and one of them I'd like to share with you guys. It's by a band called the Helly Goats. I don't really love that name, but I really like this song. It's called Goodness Gracious Goodnight.
I got a driver's sidearm. I got distribution. I got people in a rut. They know I love them, but they don't know how much. It was an interesting angle to be lame when you say we're on the same page. When you say I should be singing your praises, anxiously waiting for the next note you play me. That's crazy. Out of all that I've received, you gave me something that I never knew I needed. I never knew I was frozen until you turned on.
So the last line is goodness gracious goodnight. So when I sing this to my oldest daughter, who's 4 minutes older than my youngest, and I get to that line, goodness gracious good night, she knows like it's time to get in the bed, and she'll like kind of go limp and reach down and go into the bed. It's one of the cutest things in the world.
Oh, Dave, I love that. Sounds like a great family tradition.
It's like adorable operant conditioning.
Yeah, put a behavioral spin on it and it's not so cute anymore. Just suck the romance right out of that one, Ryan. Good job. So, Dave, we love that story about operant conditioning of your daughters.
Steele, unfortunately, this episode's coming to an end. This will be the first time ever that I'll be sharing some book wisdom. Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a whole paragraph. This is from All the Pretty Horses by Cormac McCarthy. I love him. I live in Arizona, and I love the desert. The desert's my favorite climate in the world, and he just captures it. It's great. So I'm just going to read what I have here. This is a passage from All the Pretty Horses. The desert he rode was red, and red the dust he raised, the small dust that powdered the legs of the horse he rode, the horse he led. In the evening, a wind came up and reddened all the sky before him. There were few cattle in that country, because it was barren country. Indeed, yet he came at evening upon a solitary bull, rolling in the dust against the blood-red sunset like an animal in sacrificial torment. The blood-red dust blew down out of the sun. He touched the horse with his heels and rode on. He rode with the sun coppering his face and the red wind blowing out of the west across the eating land, and the small desert birds flew chittering among the dry bracken, and horse and rider and horse passed on. And their long shadows passed in tandem, like the shadow of a single being, passed and paled into the darkening land, the world to come. That's it.
Off the chain. He's off the chain. Welcome to this world. It's off the chain.
I got a mostly naked baby walking around here with shirt off. Wait, legitimate walking?
Baby steps.
Yeah.
He can stand up and then he can fall down, which is most of what walking entails.
Yeah, he's there. You just have to train him to flex his muscles.